welcome to the latest episode of the My Imaginary Universities podcast, in which notable sector figures are invited to dream up a fictional university. This time we have Professor Adam Tickell, who's Vice Chancellor and Principal at the University of Birmingham, who delivers a novel idea to improve Parliament, politics and public discourse. Adam presents us with Democracy University, a very special kind of institution which provides compulsory training for all legislators who will in future be required to graduate from DU before taking up their elected places. MPs and others receive rigorous training featuring different ways of thinking from Hobbes to Rawls, as well as studying literature and learning how best to evaluate evidence, both quantitative and qualitative. On this leafy Midlands base campus, students enjoy a compulsory and stratified residential experience, mixing with other legislators from across the world. The university offers a home to think tanks from across the political spectrum too, to ensure all points of view are covered in both teaching and research. And access to the internet is severely restricted by a vice chancellor who enjoys all the powers of an absolute monarch. DU's anthem is, appropriately, an impressive Gil Scott-Heron political epic. I do hope you agree it's an excellent episode. Right, well, welcome everyone to the latest episode in the My Imaginary University series. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Professor Adam Tickell, who's Vice Chancellor and Principal at the University of Birmingham. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, Paul. It's really a real pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, it's fantastic to have you on. We did, of course, have your predecessor on a while back, and I'd encourage people to listen to his recording as well, and you might do a compare and contrast. But it's fair to say I let him boss me in a way that I don't know if you will as well. So he bent the rules, to be honest, Adam. So we'll see if you're a bit more compliant than he was. So it's really great to have you on. And of course it's always slightly challenging for someone who is a vice chancellor to put you in charge of an entirely potentially fictional university, but is also hopefully a bit of a release from the harsh realities of university life in contemporary Britain. So And just to be clear, I have no idea what you're going to propose in terms of your institution that you've created. So we'd better dive straight in and find out exactly what you've come up with. So what kind of institution have you imagined for us?
Well, Paul, I'm going to give you a politician's answer, and that will be pertinent in a minute. So I'm not going to answer your question straight away, but I promise I will answer it. So please don't go and listen to David Eastwood's before you listen to mine, because that was an exercise in erudition and knowledge, which you're not going to get from his successor. I should say I struggled a bit with this because in my first iteration of this, I realised that what I was really doing is describing the University of Birmingham with a few enhancements, and that fails the test. But then I realised that the UK is genuinely really well served by a very broad range of universities with a great set of diverse missions. And in that context, is there really space for another university in the firmament? But I realise that there is a gaping hole. And this gaping hole is what we at Democracy University will fill. The premise of Democracy University is that every elected, and I should stress selected, lawmaker to the UK Parliament and their counterparts to the chambers in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland will compulsorily have to attend the Democracy University before they legislate. At Democracy University, we recognise that most of our students will already be highly qualified academically, or actually many of them will have PhDs from the University of Life or the College of Common Sense. But Democracy University will have a unique offering to enhance our democracy. We will obviously provide training in framing, drafting and interrogating legislation. You know, that's kind of almost like 101. We'll give them training in public speaking and in effective communication. And these are, of course, essential skills. But none of our alumni will be dumb enough to sink tens of millions of pounds into unworkable schemes that they know aren't going to work and their counterparts know aren't going to work. But And I'll pause for a minute because I'm sure there are questions you'll have. But more importantly, our overwhelming emphasis will be on listening well and debating well. So there are lots of ways that we're going to make sure this curriculum and this programme can work. But fundamentally, this is a compulsory programme that the students at Democracy University will thrive in.
Wow. Okay, that's a really interesting idea. And I'm sure in terms of raising the standard of legislators' behaviour and indeed public debate, it will be a bit of a game changer. The obvious practical question is at what point is there a gap, therefore, between the general election result and them taking their seats in the various legislatures? Or do they do it part time whilst legislating? How does that work?
Oh no, I don't think you ought to be able to legislate until you've graduated from DU. And so I'm taking my cue here from the United States, where of course they have an election in November, and the new president doesn't take over until after Christmas. So it will necessarily have to be a very intense programme. So we've thought really quite hard about how we're going to accommodate our students and how we're going to teach them. But I think that, you know, unless they've got a couple of months of really hard training behind them, they're not going to be equipped to do what is fundamentally one of the most important jobs we have in our society.
And before we go to the detail of what they're actually studying, which I am intrigued about, I mean, it's going to be a fairly modest sized institution then, isn't it? And is presumably, is it going to do other things as well? Because, you know, you could argue that it's only going to run that one course every year or so, what with, you know, regional elections. Is it going to do other councils as well, or is it just going to be the parliaments?
Well, I think we need to be honest about the potential, don't we? Because, you know, we know that Britain's universities are the best in the world, and so there's no reason why we can't take the home of democracy, we can't give an offer to other democracies that are struggling. So, you know, look over the Atlantic. It's clearly the case that there are problems in American democracy. There are 50 state legislatures. There's two houses. So, you know, that's a great market for us. Canada similarly. So, you know, you can think in the Anglophonic world alone, there's a great opportunity. And we know that democracy, liberal democracy, is under threat. So how better could it be that we offer these opportunities to countries where democracy is maybe somewhat less established?
So do you get your funding directly from the public person, or are you expected to recruit internationally in order to help cover your costs?
Well, I think we have to have a hybrid model. I think clearly, you know, at the moment in the UK and in most polities, you have a hybrid model where the public pays and the individual student pays. And I don't think it's reasonable for us to say to undergraduate students at what I will call normal universities, but of course, British universities are much more than normal. They have to pay contribution towards their education. And London Economics suggests it's somewhere in the region of 15% of the total cost is publicly held, and the rest is held by students. Actually, I think it's reasonable for the public purse to pay a very considerable contribution towards promoting our democracy. But I think we should also ask our legislators to make a contribution themselves, because they too will be benefiting for it. And of course, they'll be legislating on student fees themselves. So they need to have a stake in the system that they design.
So in this really intent, let's stick with the UK Parliament for the moment, and I'll come back to these the other nations home and away as well. But this intense course that they're doing for, you know, 3 months or whatever it might be. So what are they actually going to be studying during that time?
Well, as I said a few minutes ago, I think you're going to have a number of core programs. We absolutely have to provide a rigorous training in how legislation works, in how it's framed, it's how it's drafted. The House of Commons and House of Lords clerks do an outstanding job, but really what they're doing is they're taking some ideas and then turning it into legislation. So wouldn't it be better if the people who are giving them the ideas started off with an understanding of what a good law would look like? But of course, not everybody is a framer of legislation. It's only a minority of lawmakers which really make the law. The rest are in, their job is, if you like, it's a governance function. It's how you interrogate it. So how do you do select committees well? How do you hold ministers to account? How do you call people like me in front of a public affairs committee, public accounts committee? And how do you get big people who are publicly funded to get the best out of them, rather than just having some form of meaningless interrogation, which looks good for the cameras, but doesn't add to the sum of human endeavor? So I think there's the core curriculum is clearly around good legislation. I think one of the things that is going to be central to our program, though, is an idea of intellectual and political heterodoxy. What I've noticed over my career is, when I started, the narrative was always people who come from the political left can't get jobs in universities, and particularly in the social sciences. And now, of course, it's got 180 degrees, and it's really difficult for people who are of the political right to get that. And I think it denudes our universities. Actually, I think it denudes our democracy when you get a groupthink. So our tutors will be absolutely drawn from as many edgy ends of the political spectrum and the centre as they possibly can be to challenge people's preconceptions and pre-existing ideas, such that they can feel confident, even if they don't change their fundamental belief systems, they feel confident that they've been tested rigorously rather than just in the hothouse of a debating chamber. So we will be ensuring that there's a very strong training and development in different ways of thinking. And some of this may be as simple as getting them to go back and read basic political theory. So you're starting with Hobbes and going through Paine and right up to Rawls. But others of it, I think, is one of the best things that we can do is we can train people in reading novels. What we tend to do is we tend to be very rationalist in the way that we understand the human condition. But I mean, certainly for me, the way that I understand the world best is when I read good novels. And so we will have a rigorous training in literature, in music, so that people understand emotion and understand the role of emotion in changing society.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the final absolutely essential core module, if you like, is evaluation of evidence. So a graduate of Democracy U will be capable, at their very least, of reading statistical data. They don't need to be a quantitative analyst, but they need to be able to read a spreadsheet, read a balance sheet, and make sense of it. They also need to be able to read qualitative data, because you often get people at either end of the spectrum who just go on the numbers and think that that's the answer to everything, or who will tell very rich stories. What we'll do is we'll provide a training in mixed research methods.
Right. That's really good. I love the development along creativity and arts and culture. I think that's a really nice idea. And so would there be the kind of personal development kind of ideas as well, around communications, around presentational skills, around those kind of things? Or are you kind of content to leave people be to play their own furrow there?
Yeah, I'm a bit torn about this, because I think, you know, clearly the value that, you know, the quality of public debate matters, and it does matter that people can communicate effectively. But what we don't want to do at Democracy U is to create a cadre who, when they go to the next election, they've been so well trained in public speaking and political communication that what they're going to do is they're automatically going to get re-elected. So it could be that we do have some very particular training. But if you do that, then we'll have to have some sort of brainwashing exercise at the end of a parliamentary term. So we haven't quite worked out how we're going to do that. But we've got a great bunch of psychologists on team. We've got a white noise room. And so we've thought very carefully about if we need to deprogram as well as program.
No, that's a really interesting idea. And so in terms of tailoring, I mean, presumably there would be distinctive aspects of Scottish culture you would deal with, as well as Welsh and Northern Irish, as well as those adaptations for the international audience.
Well, I think so too. So, the reason I'm hesitating in my answer is that what we also want to do is we want to challenge people's pre-existing life experiences. So what I don't want to do is I don't want people in Scotland just to have a very strong sense of Scottishness, such that it reifies that sense that Scotland is so different. I mean, and I should say, and I'll alienate some of your listeners here, I'm a believer in the value of the United Kingdom. So what we don't want to do as Democracy U is to create centrifugal forces to pull it apart. Yeah. And that will clearly cause difficulties both with Plaid and with SNP and ALBA and so on. So we'd need to work out exactly how we do that. But the broader point is, we were thinking about the fact that people come to Parliament with very different life experiences, and we want to expose them to alternative ways of thinking. So the way we thought about this, probably most detailed way, is we've developed an outstanding campus, and this is why it's important to make sure that we can have people from around the world occupying it for more than a few weeks every year. People will be allocated accommodation, and it is compulsory live-in. I have to be clear that you're not allowed to be a commuter student in this environment. And student accommodation will be allocated in inverse relationship to somebody's pre-existing experiences. So if you're a hereditary peer, then you'll be living in a tower block with somebody, as I did when I was a student myself. Actually, I lived in one of the Crescents in Hume. Anybody who remembers those, they were based on the Crescents in Bath, and that was the only thing they had in common was the shape. I was unfortunate enough to live for some months next to somebody who spent his whole life playing the drums and smoking cannabis, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, the amount of cannabis in his brain meant that he had to play his drums very loud. And I would go and knock on the door every night, and he would say, "Oh, sorry, mate," and then half an hour later be playing them again. Eventually, we called the police, and we moved out the next day. So,
you're going for the physical experience rather than the. You're not going to bring in.
I've lost contact with him, unfortunately, so I won't be able to invite him to come and live next to Lord Fauntleroy. I think equally, somebody who's had an experience being brought up in a one parent family in a council house, then it would be great for them to experience life in more luxurious accommodation, just to understand viscerally what it feels like. So, you know, obviously those are very extreme ends of the spectrum, and most people live fairly comfortable lives.
So it's very much a residential, compulsory residential, stratified campus experience for our new MPs and legislators, right? Where is it?
Well, I think it has to be, you know, we're both based in the Midlands. I think it has to be based somewhere in the Midlands, because otherwise you can't be in London, because it's sort of, that will reproduce the sense that London is the only important place. So I think it's probably in the Midlands. I think it needs to be in a city, principally because cities are where everything vibrant happens. And I spent enough time living in the countryside when I was a teenager to realise that the countryside is really good for holidays and agriculture, but cities are good for everything else. So I think it's really important, and then it will mean that our legislators are able to draw upon the very diverse sort of cultural lives that cities offer.
Right. Okay. So we're in a leafy campus on the outskirts, perhaps, of a significant Midlands city. Right. That and so we've got people coming in and out for chunks of time from around the world and around the UK. Are there other things happening on campus? So in two dimensions. One is, are those staff, that variety of staff, are they prosecuting research as well? Are they filling their time usefully in research terms? But also in terms of the experience that those all of them will be mature students are having, are they doing any of the other things typical students would do, or is it very much intensely focused on the work?
So that's two very different questions. I think this is not a just simply a training camp. It is a university, and universities are best when they're constellations of education and research. I mean, these are our missions. So we will clearly have a permanent staff, like the best of the French Grand Ecoles. I think, in honesty, we need to have people who are at the forefront of their field. So I was wondering whether we should do something like bring the Institute of Government and similar sort of bodies into it. I also think one of the things that the UK suffers from to a significant degree, as compared with our friends in the United States, is that we don't have such a developed think tank network and think tank community. And of course, Democracy U can be the solution to that as well. So rather than having privately funded, or maybe we should continue to have philanthropically and privately funded think tanks, but they can have a home at DU. In the way that if you're in Washington, D.C., I don't know if you've ever been to Washington, D.C., it's a really interesting town. If you go up and down, there's a place in D.C. that's called K Street. I mean, it is K Street. And K Street is shorthand for the constellation of think tanks. And so you have the think tanks based here. And, you know, we are heterodox. So we'll have Adam Smith Institute and Onward and Policy Exchange will come with us. But we'll also have independent think tanks like Chatham House, Institute of Government. And then we'll have think tanks of the liberal and the left and for nationalists. So this also, I think, will help the think tank community to listen and work together rather than just constantly jostle for headlines in the press.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah.
That's what we'll do. So we will be enhancing democracy and pursuing research. And actually, I think one of the advantages of having that kind of community, so it's think tanks and policy engaged academics, is that they can, throughout the time, they can work with the alumni of DU to feed in new ideas in the way that that will so help to revitalize our democracy.
Yeah.
In terms of what they do, I think I'm a great believer that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy or Jackie a dull girl. So clearly, it will be very important to have a wide range of extracurricular activity. And a very distinctive feature of Democracy U will be, in order to promote people's listening skills and mindfulness, is that every morning we'll start off with an hour of yoga.
Just an hour?
I think an hour will be sufficient, because for some people it will be quite a struggle. So one of the lovely things about yoga is that you can be really rubbish and still get stuff out of it, because it's not a competitive sport. It's something that where you're just improving all the time. So I think this will help start the day by centering people. And I in my mind, I'm already visualizing members of the House of Lords lying on a yoga mat and then getting up to do down talk.
A real enhancement to the student experience. I could say, will there be a students union? Will you have sports teams? You know, how will that, is that part of it as well? Or is that simply, I mean, does it really work on these short intensive programs?
I think it probably won't. I think what we can help them to do is to set up their own sports teams. So I think one of the things that does work about about Westminster is there are, all party parliamentary groups on lacrosse or football or whatever. And yeah. I think we can help them think about how they can maintain this sense of collegiality when they've graduated.
going back to the, I mean, I like the idea of actually, you know, kind of bringing all the think tanks in, and I think that that does make a difference. I mean, but presumably, and one of the things about that's always struck me about our structures compared with the US is actually how breathtakingly under-resourced our representatives are compared with their US counterparts, right? You know, you're lucky if you're able to stretch your resources to, you know, a couple of people in the constituency and one in Westmead. And that just seems, if you're expecting people genuinely to provide the kind of representative functions we look to our MPs to do, and to think about stuff and to develop new ideas and to come up with it, that it just seems woefully inadequate. So actually part of bringing all this thing together does actually make sense in terms of getting the maximum value out of those limited resources and generating new ideas and helping people. So I think that's a really creative approach. And the whole operation seems like a bit of a bargain, frankly, given that, it'll only cost a few hundred million, really, won't it? It'll be dirt cheap.
Yeah, I mean, it will cost us less every year than it would cost not to send anybody to Rwanda.
Excellent. So that's a very contemporary reference. And of course, one of the striking features of UK governments over many, many years has been, you know, for all the occasional policy successes, is the catalogue of failures, right? And presumably, what part of this will be doing will be learning from all of those major policy mistakes down the years, from, you know, dangerous dogs to Rwanda to the NHS IT programme and so forth. And presumably, these landmark failures like the poll tax and whatever will also be some things that will be studied by our legislators.
Do you know what? We hadn't got that into our curriculum yet, but such a great idea. I'm going to invite you to be a visiting professor.
Well, I just read from the blunders of our governments. You know, that'll be but you just get to read that.
Yeah, I the more I think about it, the better idea it is. I think, if you're thinking about what makes good legislation, then you do that by reference to what makes bad as well.
It is a fabulous book and really salutary reading. And so thinking again about the mentioned before about your predecessor, but I mean, and you obviously have experience of being a vice chancellor at your current university and your previous one, would you want to do this one as well? I mean, would it be sufficiently attractive to you to give up all the pleasures of Birmingham to do it, or would you prefer to allocate the role to someone else?
Yeah, so listen, that's a tricky question, because as I said at the beginning when we were talking, I said that my first iteration of this actually turned out to be the University of Birmingham, and it's an indication of how much I love my current job. But having said that, I'm one of the people who actually genuinely, and joking aside, I genuinely respect and like almost every politician I've ever come across, irrespective of whether I share or don't share their politics. And I know how genuinely committed most of them are to making the world a better place, even if their premise of what a better place would be is different to what mine might be. So I think helping them and working with them would be a real privilege.
So are there other features of the university that we haven't explored that you were particularly keen to highlight? Because it's pretty blooming novel at the moment. I'm just wondering if there are other facets that we failed to touch on.
Well, there's just a couple of things. I think the first of them is that I was reflecting. I think if you think back to, I'm sure you've seen the Coen Brothers movie, No Country for Old Men. Which is a very, very, if you haven't seen it, anybody, you should check it out. But it is heart-wrenchingly sickening to watch every now and again. But its premise is there's a mass murderer on the loose, and he appears almost out of nowhere, and it's horrible. But it was based in 1980. And the reason, although it was made much later, it was based in 1980 because it was pre-mobile phone and pre-internet. And I was reflecting on that as we think about how much people will pick up their phones and get distracted. So what we're going to do is we're going to build a giant Faraday cage such that there is mobile communication coming into Democracy U. The only people who will have an exemption to that are bona fide researchers who can prove they need the data, access to the internet in order to do their research effectively. And that will stop people posting on Instagram or getting distracted by TikTok or whatever nefarious activities they may be up to. I think that will be very different to any university I'm aware of. In fact, it's such a good idea, I've asked my registrar to mock one up for Birmingham for next week.
And I'm sure it'll be universally welcomed by staff and students alike. but there might be some pushback. I think you also need to allow security probably to have communications devices just in case, you know, there's a bit of a ruck after yoga.
That's a very good point. I think we'll have to get the and MI5 will clearly have to have access to as well. So yeah, we'll work around that. That's a great corrective. The other thing we haven't really touched on is the kind of vice chancellor that this university needs.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this in terms of the British political settlement. And initially I thought that the VC would need to be some kind of, you know, have a speaker role. And I think, you know, clearly there will be an element of speaker. But I thought harder. And given the nature of the student population, I actually think the vice chancellor will need to be an absolute monarch.
It's an interesting approach. It might not be willingly accepted by the populace, though.
It might not be. But remember, in order to assume their role in their chamber, they have to pass. And you know, if you don't accept the legitimacy of the absolute monarch, then clearly you're not going to pass. Just as we have the situation where some MPs don't actually legislate because they refuse to serve to swear the solemn oath.
Right. Okay. Well, that will create another interesting dimension on campus as well, won't it? Yes. Oh right. Well, it's a novel approach, and I'm sure that there are many many individuals within the sector who'd be particularly attracted to that model and be very keen to translate it to their own institution. as well. Well, the last thing then, Adam, is it's important that this new university does have a piece of music or a theme tune that is something that all of those students and indeed staff can really relate to. So what's the anthem of Democracy U?
Yeah. So again, you know, I think given our need to think about the broad range, it was quite hard. So I toyed originally with Ode to Joy, but you know, clearly some of our Brexiteer and wouldn't be keen with that, and I can understand that. And we, you know, it is important that this place works for everybody. I then thought about my favourite Mutiny by the Coop, as they call themselves, but it's probably a bit profane. So I settled on Bee Movie by Gil Scott Heron.
And I don't know that one.
But the opening line to that is, "Mandate my ass." So it's actually, I mean, it's absolutely brilliant song.
Right. Well, that's certainly a novel selection, and one that will, I'm sure, inspire the legislators of the future to complete their course and indeed be better legislators. Well, it's a fantastic proposition, Adam, and it's been a joy exploring it with you, and I look forward to thinking further about the many benefits it would bring, and let's hope that at some point our current parliament decides that it's the right thing to do and is willing to invest in it, and indeed you might be able to persuade them successfully that should be the case. But thank you so much, that's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, Thank you for listening.